Naomi Mayer. I'm content manager of LitNet, and it's a great honor for me today to introduce you to Bill Nassen. Bill is one of South Africa's leading historians, and he's presently a distinguished professor of history at the University of Stellenbosch. Previously, he was a history scholar at the University of Cape Town for more than two decades, where he was head of the Department of History. A historian of modern South Africa who specializes in the history of war, Nassen has also published widely in other fields, including education, politics, and oral history. The War of South Africa in 2010 was shortlisted for the Alan Paton Nonfiction Award. Bill has held visiting fellowships at the University of Cambridge, the Australian National University, Yale University, University of Illinois, University of Kent, and Trinity College in Dublin. A man of the world, an historian with a wide scope. Books by Bill Nassen include Abram Esau's War, The War of South Africa, South Africa at War, The War at Home, and a quick interruption here on my side. It was because of The War at Home, and I conducted an interview with Bill on LitNet that I became aware of his work, and he was a special author for me to interview. He wasn't simply a stereotypical non-fiction writer. He was writing like a novelist. And also, he also wrote the book World War I and the People of South Africa in 2014. Welcome, Bill Nassen.
Thank you, Naomi.
The reason for our being here today is due to the publication of his book, History Matters. Bill, maybe we can start with your telling us what kind of a book History Matters is.
Okay, thank you. This is the point at which I'm always reminded of my late father, you know. Genoeg, Bill, hoop, no. That's enough. So I think that, I don't know, I'm a sort of Gemini, and I'm easily bored and distracted, especially when I'm on my own at a desk. And for much of my life, I've admired historians who have a single topic and can work on that for most of their lives. You know, the history of tin mining in Kelsrivier or something. And I've never been much good at that, so I've always scratched around. And I was born in 1952, and in my sort of reading years, I grew up in a house which didn't have a lot of books, but we had a lot of collections, edited writing, collected books of that kind. And some of them were given to us as a family by this odd man, a Scotsman called Mr. Shaw, who I remember as a very young primary school boy. And one of the many ironies of my life is that although I grew up in an entirely unilingual English-speaking household, my father was born in Swellendam, and he was actually an Afrikaans teacher, although he never ever spoke Afrikaans at home. Nooit, never. And so Mr. Shaw used to come to my father for Afrikaans lessons because he was a magistrate in the 50s, and he was fearful of losing his job because of affirmative action of that time, and he needed desperately to learn enough Afrikaans. This is a very long-winded way of saying. But what he used to do was that he used to bring these collections of G.K. Chesterton or the stories of Saki and people like that. And so I grew up with these books, and I love them actually, because you could dip into them and walk around with them and put them down and pick them up again. And I've always liked books of that kind, but I never thought that my scribblings were worth putting together into a book of that sort until I was sitting with Tim Cousins, the great literary historian of South Africa, who very sadly died last year. And the very last thing he wrote, in fact, is the foreword he very generously wrote for this book. And Tim and I were sitting at the Frantic Literary Festival, and he said, "Come on, Bill, you lack of focus. You spend most of your life, you know, yiri-ding, dari-ding, you know, you're doing a bit of this and a bit of that. Why don't you think of putting it all together and persuading a publisher to bring out a book of your selected writing?" So in a way, the book is a sort of menopausal, late life collection of the sort of books I read when I was very young. And the other books like this, say William Boyd's Bamboo I like, and Richard Hoggart's, I forget the title, but things of that kind. So it's not an autobiography, but it's a collection of the various things I wrote many years ago and some I've written more recently. So it's written for myself, for enjoyment, I think, and hopefully for one or two other readers, maybe more if I'm lucky.
And Bill, what kind of topics do you cover in this book, and where did it all start?
It all started with the school magazine, which is the very first thing I... my very first publication was the school magazine, which I was involved in founding in 1969, 1970. So they had to publish me because I was the editor. And then I wrote a very boring, serious piece about dissent, and you'll read it in the book if you ever get around to looking at it. And so what it is, it's a sort of partly chronological. I mean, I must say it's not a memoir. I mean, there are some pieces in it that are flashes or moments of memory, which I've written specifically for the book. But everything else is over quite a long period of time, from 1970 up till very recently. Previously published, but I've rewritten them for this book. I've got rid of any boring references and footnotes. Good time, good for that actually. Once you get to a certain age, you can live without references and footnotes. Who worries, you know? And you can read the originals to find the references. So they are a kind of mixture of, they kind of book reviews, and there's some poetry, not by me, I can't write poetry, but there are a couple of poems which are embarrassingly about me. And then there are essays and lectures and book reviews and review essays and ruminations. So it's a sort of, I don't know, it's like a lucky dip or an unlucky dip, depending on your view of it. But
And Bill, do elaborate a bit about the poem about you, if you wish.
Okay, there's a thing in the book about a daffodil, and it was when I was a part-time student, and I had I was enrolled in something called the South African Committee for Higher Education, which is the early 1970s, and you either had sort of UCT tutors, and it was correspondence. You studied by correspondence, and it was through London University. And you had local tutors, or you had visiting academics who were here to do research. And this is period around 1971, 72. And I had this man called Wally Mills, who was a Canadian and was working on Christianity and missions in the Eastern Cape. So he was doing his PhD through the University of California. And I used to go to their flat in Tamboerskloof for these weekly tutorials. And his wife, who was a very interesting, willowy, interesting sort of Canadian woman who was also a poet, and she suddenly discovered that I was interested in Leonard Cohen and Margaret Atwood and Canadian writers because of the peculiar education I'd had. And so she used to sit in the lounge while the two of us had a tutorial at the table about something really boring, you know, like Charles Fox and the English East India Company. And she would lie on the couch and then chip in saying, "Oh, that's so boring. Why don't you talk about something more interesting, like some 18th century novel or other?" And then there was one week I went and she'd gone. She'd just disappeared, just vanished. And I was whatever I was then, 19 or 20, and I didn't... I don't know, you're not an adult really, and I didn't really think about it. And then one day, months later, I never asked Bonnie, you know, "Where's your wife? Have you done her in? Cut her up? Sent her back to Canada? Who knows?" And then one week, I walked past the bedroom door, and there she was lying on the bed, and I could see these very distinctive blue stockings and whatever. And when they left, after about a year, she was there. Magically, you know, out of the hat, and then it was as if nothing had happened. And then about a year after that, I received a collection of her poems, and one of the poems was about me and those tutorials we had. And it was about whether I ever thought about what had happened to her in that time, which I realized, not even then, but much later, was obviously about, you know, depression or withdrawal or something that you only realize when you're fully an adult that you understand these things. So that, for me, was one of the very moving pieces in a book, which is otherwise quite shallow, I think, because I'm a fundamentally shallow person. Probably, you know.
And Bill, do you want to tell something about a train trip and how you became a historian?
Oh, I became an historian. Yeah, I was. I sort of left South Africa in 1972, and then I studied in Britain, and then I was working in London at World University Service in North London, having a pretty terrible time, the sort of office job. And we were working with Ugandan student refugees and Eritrean student refugees and Zimbabwean student refugees who were all sort of stranded in Britain because their scholarship funding had dried up. And I worked with two women I couldn't stand. I mean, they happened to be women, but, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, gender politics here, but they were not easy to work with. So I was very frustrated and cross and fed up. And then I went to the station one evening and got into the Underground, the Northern Line. We all know the London Underground. Got into the Northern Line. And the door opened, and a sort of large, fat, boozy man got on and sat down opposite me. And I thought, oh, my God, that's John Kenyon. He was the head of history where I'd done my first degree at the University of Hull in northeast England. A very conservative figure, and he was an historian of the 17th century who wrote books with wonderful titles like The Stuarts or The Popish Plot, that kind of stuff. So he was like a 17th century English historian. And I tried to avoid his gaze, and then he kind of stared at me and said, Nassan, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I was in London working. And he said, why are you wasting your time working? You should be doing something like research. Do a PhD. And I said, well, how do I do that? He says, let me tell you. Phone me. And he gave me his phone number, and he got off at the next stop. So I did. And that's how I became an historian. So he said to me, this is where you apply, and this is where you'll get funding, and I will write the references. So it's all about patronage, you know. It's a story of life. We all know this.
So did
so I'm, you know, like that William Hurt movie, The Accidental Tourist. So I'm the accidental historian. Otherwise, I might have just stayed in North London, and you would have found me on the Underground line eventually, jumping in front of the Northern Line, you know, when I'd had enough.
Now, did that also influence the fact that you wrote plenty of your work from the perspective of the British? Or do you want to say something about that?
Yes. Yes, I did. I have written some things. It's a funny thing, actually. I mean, I sort of went to Britain in 1972. And then, so I sort of grew up in Cape Town, and always with this sense of England or Britain in my head, which seemed to be a place that was more open and more free. And, you know, when you sort of, your body's here, but your mind migrates somewhere else, intellectually and emotionally. And then I ended up, not in London, where so many people end up, but in Hull, cold, wet, damp, unpleasant part of northeast England. But it was great, actually, because you could immediately become deracinated. The Yorkshires didn't know foreigners. I mean, many decades before Brexit, before the Poles arrived. So you could become kind of absorbed. I mean, you couldn't become Yorkshire. That's impossible, as anyone would tell you. But it was... It was an interesting experience, you know, that I think that sense, when I went to England, that strong sense of other parts of the British Isles, which maybe you don't get in the same way in the South, so that if you meet people from Manchester, and then you meet people from Ireland, and you meet people from Scotland. And when I was there in 1973, 76, doing history, I had these Irish friends, and of course the IRA was very active during that period, and they became quite fiercely republicanized during that period and changed the spelling of their names, I mean, to assert their Irishness, which was very interesting, actually. And then later, when I left my then-girlfriend and I, my long-suffering wife now, we lived in North London, and then we lived in Kilburn, and anyone who knows Kilburn is full of Irish pubs and full of Fenians and then full of dynamite and, you know, subversives. And so that was another interesting experience, being immersed in the sort of Irishness of a part of North London.
Since you've mentioned the Irish, maybe if you wish, you can maybe tell us something about the Easter Rising from your book as well.
Oh, what? Yeah. I've always been interested in Ireland, and I think Ireland is not entirely unlike South Africa. It's where you have this, don't know what it is, this mix of strong sense of history, mixed up with politics or historical grievances. So there are a lot of historical grievances of various kinds in this country, and a bit like Ireland in that sense. And then it becomes mixed up with sort of contemporary politics, and then it becomes mixed up with nationalism, old nationalism or new nationalism, and it's all a very, not a very pleasant sort of mix. I've had links with Trinity College Dublin, which is, of course, Protestant, historically. If you go to Trinity College Dublin today, there's a portrait of Oliver Cromwell, you know, the great murderer and colonizer of Ireland. And if you go to University College, just up the road, that's Catholic. And there's Cardinal Newman Hall. So I was asked in 2015 to give a lecture on the Afrikaner Rebellion and the Irish Rising, and to look at similarities and differences between these two events. And one of the things I remember was I started off by talking about a wonderful Irish historian, a man called Roy Foster, and there was this thaw in the audience. There was this chill, this sort of hostile look from people. This was in Dublin. And it was a bit like, I don't know, like a bar mitzvah pork chop or something, you know. And I just knew at that moment that Roy Foster was the wrong person to start with, because he was in Oxford, he was in England, and he was a protty. He was a Protestant. And the people in the audience were overwhelmingly Catholic nationalists. But so Ireland is always, yeah. And then when I was a student, I studied a lot of Irish writers as an English undergraduate. And one of the things in my book, I have a list of favorite quotes at the end of, the very end of the book. And one of them is from Brendan Behan, who describes himself as having been a drinker with a writing problem, which is wonderfully Irish, I think.
So in a way, you're interested in the history of the underdog, are you? Is that, am I right?
Yes, and everybody.
Yes.
And the powerful too. I mean, I think, I don't know, slightly banal thing to say, but I think that, you know, what you can kind of get for, I mean, what does history teach us? And I think that if there's one thing that history teaches us is the importance of, there's no such thing as objective history, but you have to have some kind of empathy with the people you are studying and writing about, whether they are the underdog or whether they are the top dog and the powerful. Because everybody can be damaged, everybody can be hurt, everybody can lose, everybody can gain. And I think that's very important, actually, to get, you know, so that there was a time in my life when I wrote a very advocacy, I suppose, partisan kind of history. But I wouldn't write that kind of history now, I think.
Bill, you've done a lot of research in the history of war in general, all kinds of war. Do you want to say something about why you've done that? What all the wars you've looked at? The Anglo-Boer War, World War One, Two. Anything you wish to?
Yes, I would always have loved. I would love to study the Seven Years' War, but I never will. But you know that famous French Anglo-French War. That fame where Admiral Byng, it's a complicated story, but Admiral Byng was told by the British Admiral to sail his ship at the French and display bravery. And he said, no, my ship will go down and my crew will die. And so he disobeyed orders. And he was then court-martialed and executed on the deck of his ship in 1782 or something. A man after my heart. You know what I mean? A bit like General Klopper in Tobruk in the Second World War, where General Klopper did a similar thing, who's gone down in history as a sort of, quote, coward. But if you think back to that time, was probably trying his best to save the lives of the people under his command. So yes, I mean, I've always been interested in war. It's an unhealthy interest, probably, starting with childhood and toy soldiers and model aeroplanes. Now I've been obsessed with the Second World War for quite a long time, and so I suppose I started studying it seriously with the South African War, Anglo-Boer War, when I was looking for a topic. And so the Anglo-Boer War was something I sort of started on and doesn't quite seem to leave me despite my constant efforts to get rid of it. Other Anglo-Boer War historians in the audience will know what I mean. And then I got onto the First World War. A lot of these things are, quite frankly, by sort of accident. I mean, I had a job at Cambridge. I'd never really thought seriously about the First World War. And then I got this job for a year working on a project to do with First World War pensioners. And the job was, the job was to do a 10% sample of 600,000 First World War British pensioners who had lost limbs or been gassed or in one or other way been seriously injured in the First World War. And so I got that because it was a job, and it was a very messy job. It was in a sort of warehouse, and the pigeons had got in among the files, and this was in Lancashire. And so everything was a mess. You know, you needed to work in sort of overalls. But I did this job for about a year. And then, of course, you become completely obsessed and absorbed by the First World War, because these extraordinary files which contain x-rays and letters from the employers and letters when they die, letters from their widows, and extraordinary things. For example, when a First World War veteran died, their widows were monitored by the local police to make sure that they behaved in a way which was appropriate to the widow of a hero of the First World War. And the cops would then report them to the pensions ministry saying, Mrs. X has been seen in a pub with a gentleman caller who is unrelated to her and is not her late husband. And she's dishonoring, is she not dishonoring, blah, 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 you know, a hero of the First World War veteran, and that thought should be given to stopping a pension. That stuff, extraordinary, really. So that's what, you know, and I think it's those, don't know what it is, these crinkly things around the war. I mean, not just the big stuff about the battles, but, you know, if you take the South African War, you could have, I dare say, I'm complicit in this, you know, books about the camps and children and the experience of civilians in that war. But there are also other things that, I mean, the hundreds of Boer children who were sent away by their families when the war broke out. And they were sent to Swaziland and Basutoland and Bechuanaland in 1899. And when the war ended, they came back. And what did they come back as? Sotho, Tswana, and Swazi. They came back speaking those languages.
Yes.
And having absorbed those culture, you know, because they were very young children. So after 1902, they had to be kind of re-Boerized or re-Afrikanerized or whatever. So it became a great, you know, exercise, or a small exercise in social engineering. But those are the things that, yeah.
You're all the time writing down individual people's stories in a way. Now, talking about individual people's stories, you mentioned a teacher of yours, Dudley was his surname. Do you want to say something
Mr.
about
Dudley.
Him?
Good grief, yeah.
The book was dedicated to him.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yeah. Now, he was yes. He's the closest I would get to hero worship. I mean, he was this sort of towering teacher we had at school who technically taught maths and physics, but in fact taught everything in a Renaissance man person kind of way. And can I tell the chicken story? I mean, there's, to give an example of teaching, which has really sort of stuck with me, so that there was a period when I was about sort of standard 9, and the various things went on in the school. So we would have these periodic school inspectors who would come around, who were basically these old kind of nationalists who had worked in the education department and then inspected schools. Mr. Dudley always used to say to us, when Meneer so-and-so comes, be very polite, but do not stand when he enters the classroom. Just make him feel a little bit that he's not that welcome, but we'll tolerate him. And it was a great moment, you know. So this guy would come in and he'd stand there, Wachebiki, stand up, and nobody stood. And that was just a little bit of resistance or insolence. But he also had this way of teaching in a, I know it's extraordinary. I mean, you'd get physics and Wordsworth and Shelley and, you know, poetry and physics all rolled into one. And then we had a very daring boy in the class who said, let's sort of test him. So we're going to try to eat a complete roast chicken. It's in the book, actually, that memory, while he's teaching to see if he reacts. And so this, of course, you can smell it. I mean, this roast chicken was in the classroom, and Dick Dudley came in, and he started teaching, and the chicken was passed around under the desk, and we wolfed it down, you know, and he walked around. And then at the end of the lesson, the bell went. And as we were all filing out, because we changed classrooms and he stayed where he was, he said, by the way, next time leave me a bit of the breast. That's my favorite part. Which for me is the greatest teaching moment I've ever, because it was gentle but humiliating for us, you know. I mean, the moral victory was his. He made us look stupid. And we just admired him much more. Any lesser teacher would have sent us to, you know, detention or something.
So you can write about every institution's history, in fact. Is that right? And how do you know which one is more important? If you think about your school...
Yes. Well, I think the school wasn't famous for sport. I came out of that culture of particular set of schools in Cape Town, which obviously existed before that, but came to a particular pitch, I think, in the 1960s, where there's an enormous stress on intellectual debate and the ideals of non-racialism and on internationalism, on the importance of you know, just thinking more broadly and being open to things that beyond the national boundaries where you were living. I mean, this may be guessing my favorite poem. Can I?
Yes, that's
can
what I
mean?
To.
I mean,
please.
We all belong to something called the South Peninsula Educational Fellowship, which was basically a sort of semi-Marxist socialist society. But linked to my school and to other schools, and it's that sort of apartheid period where, you know, apartheid in some levels was bad, but it's not an excuse to make it worse than it was. So the odd thing about the 60s is that there was a great deal of censorship, as everybody knows, but it was also a period of low inflation when books were very cheap and lots of things were not censored. So you could go to Court News Agency on the foreshore and buy, as I did, buy the Penguin Modern European Poets, which is what we were encouraged to buy these anti-Stalinist, very obscure Eastern European poets like Akhmatova, Yevtushenko, Voznesensky, and then we'd have these poetry readings on Friday evenings or Sunday evenings about, you know, the five-year plans or the struggle of the peasants. After a while, very boring. And so I tried to introduce what the teachers and some other students call bourgeois poets, like Dylan Thomas and Wilfred Owen and English poets. And then I sort of fell in love, loosely speaking, with a poem in about 1970, which is not in the book, but which I have bought because I last read this poem out publicly in 1970. And I said to Naomi, this is an opportunity 47 years later to read it out again publicly, maybe to a less hostile audience. Because I was told at the end of this poem that I'd fallen for bourgeois culture and that this poem was about a death wish. And it's by Roger McGough, who's one of those hip Liverpool Beatles kind of poets of that era. And it's called Let Me Die a Young Man's Death. A chance I've missed, given my age. But let me die a young man's death. Not a clean and in between the sheets, holy water death. Not a famous last words, peaceful, out of breath death. When I'm 73 and in constant good tumor, may I be mown down at dawn by a bright red sports car on my way home from an all-night party. Or when I'm 91 with silver hair and sitting in a barber's chair, may rival gangsters with ham-fisted Tommy guns burst in and give me a short back and insides. Or when I'm 104, and banned from the cavern, the famous Beatles place, banned from the cavern, may my mistress, catching me in bed with her daughter and fearing for her son, cut me up into little pieces and throw away every piece but one. Let me die a young man's death, not a free from sin, tiptoe in, candle wax and waning death, not a curtains drawn by angels born. What a nice way to go, death. Let it be a young man's death.
Yes.
Well, thank you. All I can say is you're much more appreciative than an audience in 1970 who gave me a sort of puzzled look, you know. Is he demented? Is he mad? Is he politically suspect? Because he's chosen this over Yevtushenko, Akhmatova, Voznesensky.
Well, Bill, I have to ask you, talking about that, I have to ask you something about something written in your book. You mentioned two medical doctors in the foreword. Do you want to say something about their importance, talking about a young man's death?
Oh, not a young, yes. Or let me not die an old man's death. They saved me from that. Towards the end of putting this book together, in the middle of last year, I had, I think, what's called a cardiac episode, and my bacon was saved by my GP and a cardiologist. So the cardiologist has an unhealthy eye for younger women, I've discovered. But that's another story. He's a nice guy, actually. I really recommend him. But it was coming to the end of the book, and I was actually in intensive care with the proofs when the proofs arrived. So they kind of, you know, kept me on drips and made sure that I take the rat poison and the things that keep me going today. Oh. Yeah.
Okay, but onto
they rock. Labs. That's all I can say.
Forgot about that. But onto a lighter topic, in your book you also write about other kind of histories like cricket and food and wine. Any of these three topics you'd like to say something about?
I've always loved cricket. I mean, cricket for me has been the game of life, the great moral. You know, you just, one mistake and you bug it, actually. You know, just, you can't, it's not like rugby or football where you can recover. It's just there. And cricket is full of the most heartwarming moments. I mean, I remember going to watch Western Province play Australia when the Australians were touring under Mark Taylor. And there was sort of Shane Warne, who was, you know, not playing in that match. And all these kids with their cricket bats waving to Shane to sign their bats. And he simply gestured. He opened the thing and got them out onto the side of the pitch and played with them. And cricket for me is, so I've always loved cricket. And, of course, I've always loved wine, probably to my cost. But one of the things in the book is that I did a sort of wine label, or I contributed to a wine label to Boer en Brit Wyne. And they are these two great guys, actually, Stefan Gerber and Alex Milner, hence the Boer en Brit, who produced this label, Boer en Brit, you know, with the mind of an Englishman, with the armpit of a Boer, how can you go wrong, sort of thing. Very good marketing. And when I was doing an earlier book on the war for South Africa, there was some publicity around Boer en Brit, so I got hold of them, and the earlier book has a little bit of one of the illustrations in that book is a Boer en Brit wine. So they approached me when they produced this new label called Brunghulle Heestu, which was wine targeted at expatriate South Africans in Sydney and New York and elsewhere. And it was the, it's great actually. And not the wine, but the label. And it has the train, and it's the world's first wine with luminous paint. It's kind of braaivein. So, you know, and I mean, you sit outside, there's heel wat donker, and then you can see the bottle because the coal in the coal trucks glows, and the windows are yellow, and it's great, actually. And they had a thing from Dana Sneeman, which is the tamburki or whatever, you know, some Karoo thing. And then they tried to translate it into English, and the English didn't work very well, so they said to me, would I write something in English? So I did something rather predictable about, you know, the train takes you from Colesburg to Cairo or Suez. But that was great, actually. You know, for me, who would not want to be on 20,000 bottles of wine rather than 200 books? Enige dag. No, definitely, yeah.
Now, back to the name History Matters. Now, does it? Because in the foreword you also write about students burning art in 2016. Mm. And does one make history by getting rid of history, you think? Could this be a response to history?
No, history matters because you mustn't burn things. Yes, that's a short answer.
The other question is, can history be wiped out?
No, because it has a way of coming back to bite your bum, I think. And the good example is Spain. I mean, in Spain, they renamed all these avenidas, you know, like they got rid of Franco. But in fact, if you go to Spain decades later, locals in Madrid and elsewhere will still refer to those roads by their old names. So I think there's a deep, we don't want to get too philosophical here, but I think that quite often there's a sort of deep undertow in history that you absorb by osmosis, and you can spend a lot of time prancing around trying to change the surface, but deep underneath, it's still there, you know.
Do you maybe want to read your favorite part, any quick selection of something before we open the floor for questions?
Oh, yeah. when I was younger, I keep saying that. But everyone's, as you get older, you keep saying that, when I was younger. When I was younger, I often felt that I would like to be someone else. It's like Woody Allen says the same thing, you know. I would like to be someone else, somewhere else. And yes, I think probably I would like to have been Irish, although perish the thought now. Or not Canadian, though. I mean, I nearly became Canadian, because my family nearly emigrated there in 1963 when I was 11. So then I would have been Canadian. How about that? My mother got cold feet. She said it snows. Can't go there. It's too cold. So that was it. So if you've got, I mean, this is one of the pieces I quite like, which is about the Irish Rebellion of 1916 and the Afrikaner Rebellion of 1914. So I'll just read a little extract from this, and then I can stop boring you and you can say much more interesting things. So this is the end of the lecture I gave in Dublin, and I gave the same lecture at the Frantic Literary Festival last year. Half a century after the Rising, the distinguished Afrikaans historical novelist Karel Schoeman concluded that Swart Paasfees, Black Easter, was one of the most luminous examples of the triumph of failure in world history. Do I need to start again?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. I'll start earlier then. When it comes to South Africa, and so part of it is about what you remember, what you forget. When it comes to South African remembering and forgetting, there is a brief closing Irish sequel on which to end. Half a century after the Rising, the distinguished Afrikaans historical novelist, Karel Schoeman, concluded that Swart Paasfees, Black Easter, was one of the most luminous examples of the triumph of failure in world history. In his 1966 travel journal, Berich a die Vreemde, a Ierse Dagboek, Dispatch from Abroad, an Irish Diary, and in his famous allegorical island novel, Beifakelig, of the same year, Schoeman teased out an analogy between English-oppressed Ireland and Afrikaner nationalist-ruled South Africa. But it was not the easy analogy of old, by which he meant the analogy of the Afrikaner rebellion and republicanism. The oppressiveness of aristocratic England, Schoeman concluded, was the 1960s apartheid injustice of white South Africa. Inevitably, that would, he predicted, also come to an end. Look back to Ireland, he advised Afrikaans-speaking readers of Berich a die Vreemde. Again, it offered a lesson, if not quite as unromantic as that peddled by Denise Rates. Should I say something about Denise Rates? I mean, this is, yeah. Okay, the Easter Rite. I'll finish this and then say something about Denise Rates and genoeg van mij. That's enough. The Easter Rising of 1916, he warned, had not been the end. It had been the beginning. So there's a moment. Denise Rates, of course, I'm sure many of you will know, Smuts's lieutenant, you know, got into bed with the British Empire and was in Dublin to put down the Irish Rising. And he wrote about this afterwards, and he said that the Irish reminded him so much of his own people, you know, too emotional, too wrapped up in history, too soppy, sentimental, too concerned with the past. They lacked the rationality and level-headedness of proper Irish people in the north, the Protestants. And if only, you know, his Afrikaner people and the Catholic Irish would see sense, then we would have a much more progressive future. And of course, there's an earlier story about Raitt's, which is during the Afrikaner Rebellion, when he leads a government patrol, and they're out in the Free State in some, you know, obscure dorp somewhere, and a woman runs out into the street and she says to Raitt's, thinking that they are rebels, says, "Oppas manna, the Engelse is here." And what does Danae's Raitt say? "Pas op tani, ons is die Engelse." So, yeah.
I'm afraid. Thank you. Now that's all we have time for, but there's maybe one or two questions. Just have to wait a second for the microphone. Yes.
That poem at my age, it's not in the book, so I need it.
Oh. Way out. Well, I know we should have it. We should recite it together over a glass of wine. No, it's great, isn't it? Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I loved that poem at the age of 17 or 18, and I still do now. You know, in a sort of slightly menopausal post young moment, but yeah, I missed out. That's what it is. I think that's, you know, yes.
Any more questions?
At the risk of making you self-reflect, I want to know, how do you think you'll be remembered in history?
Oh, good grief. I didn't plant that question. I mean, that's... I don't expect to be... I would like to be remembered by the people who knew me and, you know, hopefully liked me. But I don't expect to be remembered by by history, no, because you know what historians do. Historians just make history up. They don't really make history. I would love to make history, you know, like Churchill or something. Yes, yes. No, yeah, but thank you.
Any last question?
Or was a maladjusted only child? I mean, that's some other... Which we haven't discussed.
We haven't.
No, we haven't. I mean, I'm a single child, so I've got the maladjustments that go with all of that, and I've got a single daughter who's also maladjusted. So, I mean, I had a terrible childhood. She can have the same, I always thought, you know. So at least share it, you know.
This one.
Why did you come back to South Africa?
That's a good... I mean, actually, to be quite honest, I came back to South Africa because of Margaret Thatcher. Not directly. She didn't say go. Yes, I mean, I didn't... There were no jobs in Britain. And this was when I got my PhD, sort of 82, and there was sort of nothing, really. I mean, I was then married, and I had an English wife, and I would quite... happily, well, not happily, ambiguous thing about England, we didn't get, anyway, but I would have stayed, but there were no jobs in Britain, and there was a job at UCT through Herman Hillemy, there's a thing, and some other people, so that's what got me back, you know. I mean, otherwise, it's a weird thing, actually, because when I was, you know, like 11, then the whole family and the rest of them did. So I've got these Canadian and also Australian cousins and so on who've like disappeared. I don't know them, you know. I'm never there, they never come back. So there's a sort of, it's a great thing to research, I think, for people who still want to do research, unlike me who just does, you know, shallow journalistic writing. But the diaspora of the 60s, of the people who left. I mean, there were people who left in 49 and so on, and then, you know, moved abroad, but there was a big movement here, certainly from Cape Town, into Canada and Australia, where there were lots of jobs. Teaching, my father was a primary school teacher. He, you know, had a job in Canada lined up. But it didn't happen. And then, yes, so, I mean, I came back because of Mrs. Thatcher. So I have her to thank for that. I saw Mrs. Thatcher once, actually. Do you want to hear that quickly? At the Mount Nelson, at the Mount Nelson, I was having a dop with my old friend, Wilhelm Sneyman, who is at UCT in German and Italian, and he was then a Cape Times arts journalist in the days when the Cape Times was a newspaper. So we had this dop in the Mount Nelson bar, and as I was leaving, there was Mrs. Thatcher, because this was when Mark Thatcher was still living in Constantia. And sort of walking towards the door, and a bus had pulled up, and there were dozens of suitcases across the front of the front entrance of the Mount Nelson. And Mrs. Thatcher stopped and looked at the suitcases and said, "Move these now," in a very loud voice. She could have, you know, turned, maybe not left, but she could have turned right and just gone round them. But, you know, yes. So, yes. Not as interesting as P.W. Werther, but you can read Litnet for P.W. Werther.
Yes. Yes, you can. Thank you, Bill, for the lovely talk and for the interesting book.
Well, thank you. I mean, I must just say it's a great privilege to be here with Naomi, who's a proper writer. I mean, she's a novelist. She's a serious... She's the serious thing, you know. We non-fiction historians are, you know, do it for you. Yeah.